Now, you want me to repeat this?
Yeah.
My name is Walter Dudrow. I was a second lieutenant in the 93rd Engineers. We worked on the Alcan Highway. Our sector was, our railhead was in Carcross, and we built the highway from an access highway from Carcross over to Tagish, where we joined with the Alaskan Highway and then started heading south, building the highway. And we went down to just a little below the British Columbia border with our sector.
And would you give us the dates of when you came and where you joined up and so on?
Where we came?
Where did you actually enlist? And where were you from originally? A little background on yourself and then how you got up.
My home was in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. I went to West Virginia University and was in the ROTC there and got my commission as a second lieutenant in the Corps of Engineers. And I, that was in 1940, and in April of 1941, I was put on active duty, they said, for a year. And I went to Camp Livingston, Louisiana, and joined the 93rd Engineer Battalion. And we trained there for, until the next, that summer. And then we went on the maneuvers in Louisiana. And where our job where there, of course, was repairing roads and fences and things that they had broken down during the maneuvers. Then we worked on the construction of a railroad out of Camp Polk, Louisiana. Then in, February of 42, we were sent to Seattle to head for the Alaskan Highway. Of course, we had no idea where we were going. We just got on a train and went, but it was for the Alaskan Highway. And we we landed at Skagway and took the White Pass and Yukon route up to Carcross. And Carcross was our railhead.
How many of you were in that unit?
There was about 1,200 in the unit. They called it a separate battalion. And there was four companies and a headquarters company, about 1,200 troops.
And had you had building experience before you went in?
No. But, I'd had very little in the summer camps. During my training, I trained in the summer for, 6 weeks, I guess, at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And got some construction there. And I guess we got a little bit more when I went, after I got my commission, went back for 2 weeks in the summer and got a little bit more. But we were not polished engineers when we went up, but we learned fast.
What about the men you had in your unit? Did they have any experience at all?
No, none of them had any particular experience. Some were National Guard officers, and we had several West Point officers, but they were young West Point officers, first lieutenants or so they hadn't had very much experience.
And your men, were you given a choice of whether you wanted to work with black troops or not?
No, I had no idea who was going to be with. When I went with the 93rd, I had no idea what the 93rd was, and it was a good outfit. I enjoyed working with them. They were mostly Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. And I called them boys because we were all boys then. And a lot of them had couldn't read or write. And we tried to teach some of it. But then we sent a group up to Tuskegee University when Tuskegee was graduating. And we enlisted quite a few of the graduates, because they knew they were going to be drafted anyway. And we enlisted them, and when they got back and we got started in basic training, we and these graduates worked together in trying to teach the men to read and write. And we were pretty successful. I remember I was assigned as a personnel officer, and one of my duties was to make out the payroll and to get it signed and all that. And the first one that I made up, I had them sign it, and I would have to acknowledge the signature, witness the signature. That took a long time for 1,200 people. So after that, I would sign up. Not all 1,200 of them, but I signed a lot of them.
And the time were on there and were capable of signing for themselves, I think.
Yes, after a few months, it got to the point where they could all sign the payroll. And they, just that little bit of experience made them want to learn more, and we taught different things and to try to help them in some particular field, and we had them in the office work, and we had to do it pretty slowly because we were teaching them as they went on. But they got so they could handle the necessary work in the office. And one of the men from Tuskegee, his name escaped me right at the moment, but usually I can remember it. But anyway, they were waiting to get assigned, and I was working at my desk and typing. I had to do practically all the typing. And this one boy asked me, he said, could I use the typewriter while I'm waiting? And I said, sure, go ahead. And he set the typewriter behind me, and all of a sudden I heard this, and I turned around and I said, what's your name? He told me, and he said, you're assigned to headquarters company. Before he'd gotten there, and he was good. He was a good clerk, and he got to be be a master or tech sergeant pretty quickly. And then most of these boys that we had gotten from Tuskegee, later when the officers training corps opened up for the black troops, they applied, and all of them went to train as officers. But they had really done their work in helping us get organized.
Were there training programs too to drive heavy equipment and work?
Oh yes, yes, we had training for that and mechanics and how to operate all the tractors and the backhoes and everything else, and they got to be pretty good at it. And of course, after a little while on the highway, they got to be experts at it.
Did you move a lot? You were with the headquarters, so you stayed with the headquarters?
Well, we all would move every two or three days. It's trying to keep up with the mess hall mainly. But sometimes we'd get bogged down. We'd hit muskeg, and it took a long time. I remember one area, we called it the Big Devil Swamp. There wasn't any way to get around the thing. There were steep mountains on both sides of it, so we had to build a highway across this swamp, and it was just deep muskeg. Fortunately, there was a lot of woods on either side, and we could get logs for corduroy roads. and we'd put corduroy roads in, and traffic would run over for a while, and it would sink out of sight. And we calculated that we had 11 layers of corduroy on it before it finally stopped sinking. And it was about a mile and a quarter across that swamp. It took us a long time to get it, but we felt rewarded. And by the time it finished, instead of being, the road was 40 feet wide was what they wanted us to build it. And it must have been 100 feet wide because it just kept spreading out. I had this interview with a girl at the News Journal in Daytona Beach, and she asked me, what did you do for entertainment? And I said, nothing. The Carcross was the nearest town, and there were 10 white people and 125 Indians. And it was a trading post and a railroad station. And the Caribou Hotel, which wasn't a very big hotel, of course. But there wasn't much, and we were a long ways from that. So we played poker, everybody, the men and the officers and everybody, that was their entertainment whenever they got a chance to play poker. In the summer, the men were on 8-hour shifts, the officers were on 12-hour shifts. It made no difference which shift you were on because it was daylight all the time. So we could keep working around the clock pretty well. They were good workers. They were dedicated workers, and they really did an excellent job. We had one problem. The 341st Engineers were to start on an area south of us, but there wasn't any way to get in there except the helicopters, and we didn't have those in those days. So we had orders to get the 341st through. So the idea was to build this a Pioneer Road, a narrow thing that the trucks could go on. And that was an awful job, trying to get all their trucks and their heavy equipment through on these little trails. And they were in a hurry, and they would start across corduroy roads before they were ready, and they'd tear them up, and we'd have to build them over again. But the article in the National Geographic talked about the 341st Engineers, how happy they were to finally get to where they were going to start on the highway. Well, they weren't any happier than we were to get them through.
Tell me about the living conditions. Living conditions?
Well, living conditions were, of course, it was a tent. We were moving so fast. We had the big tents, I can't think. You'd get eight in a tent. And we'd put them up. They weren't winterized. Of course, in the summer, that didn't make any difference. The food, of course, they were shipping this stuff into the railhead and trying to ship it through us. Once in a while, particularly if they had fresh meat, they'd give us a fresh meat because it was getting too old, so we'd have a pretty good feast for a while. A lot of it was goat, we called it. It was mutton, I think. And the cooks tried every way they could to make it taste good, and that's impossible to make mutton taste good, I think. So the Mounties told us that we could shoot moose if it was for food. Now that was going against the law of the countries up there, but they told us we could do that. So we would send a detail out, and they would get a couple moose, and getting into September by then, and the nights were getting cool. We could hang the stuff up, and after it would hang for a week or so, it tastes very much like beef. It was a whole lot better than goat. We could send a detail out on the streams in the summer and get enough fish to feed a company. They could just get them with nets and we'd get fresh fish that way. There was a bird that was a type of partridge. They called it a fool hen. And it would fly off the ground and land on a low branch and think it was safe and you could walk up and pick it up. And we could get enough of that to have a chicken dinner once in a while. So it was rather pioneer conditions, no doubt about that. I will never forget Christmas of 1942. We were at the Robinson, which was a railroad crossing in the Yukon. And there was one cabin there, a man and his wife stayed there, and his name was Charlie McConnell. And he had gone up there in the gold rush. And he was very interesting to talk to, and he would come down to visit us and bring us to, he had a dog team with 7 huskies, and he'd come down and he'd let us drive it around the camp, and we could get it going and make it by geeing and hawing just like horses, you know. But he wouldn't tell us how to stop it. And finally, when we'd tell him we were going to let go of and let him run, he'd grunt and they'd stop and lie down. We had a lot of fun with it. But that Christmas morning, of course, that time of the year, it was so cold, it was just cooking was almost an all-day job, you know, cooking for the company. And the only road work that we were doing was grading, getting snow, and there wasn't a whole lot of snow, but keeping the snow off the highways. And this highway was one between Carcross and Whitehorse that had been a pack trail when we went up. And it was not part of the Alcan, but it was just a connecting road. But we got up that Christmas morning in a tent with a wood stove in the middle of it, and it wasn't very warm. It would heat up about 2 feet out, and then icicles were hanging down in the corner of the tent. And our thermometer said it was 73 below zero. They said, some of the others said, no, it wasn't. It was only 68, so what difference does it make, 68 or 73? But we survived, and we were practically bulletproof, because even germs can't live in that kind of temperature.
A lot of veterans told me that they had the healthiest time of their lives up there.
After we left there, we went out in the Aleutians, and I was out in the Aleutians for a year and a half, and that weather, I had a touchy sinus anyway, and it was just infected all the time. That's why I'm wearing a hearing aid, and I didn't know until after the war that the Army said it was service connected, but if this sinus infected all the time in that miserable weather out there.
But when you were working in the Alcan area and in Carcross, you did pretty well. Did your unit have any injuries or casualties?
We sent one, had one man that we had to send back to the States. He was in a car accident and had a pretty bad leg, and they sent him back to the States to treat it. And he stayed in the States. But otherwise, we were healthy. We had very little problems, and the doctors became alcoholics because they didn't have anything to do.
Did somebody do some brewing? I know the Treks eventually did quite a good bootleg service up there.
Well, the truth is, I don't know. We were so far from everything out there. Once in a while, if we'd go into Carcross, we could go to the hotel and get some of that Canadian beer, and it didn't take much of that to where you could feel it. We tried to steer clear of that as much as we could, simply because handling heavy equipment and that kind of thing, we don't want anybody getting in any trouble.
Well, local people in Carr Cross and other places you went react to the Black Peace?
They, I saw actually no reaction that was against the Black troops. They were, as I say, there was a lot of Indians around, and they were, they all seemed to get along real well. We had had no problem. I mean, that was my feeling. Now, if of course I wouldn't look at it as the way the men did, and they might have, if they had any different feelings. I never heard them say it. They always seemed to like it. We had one thing, and this has turned up in, I think in that nice geographic, it also turned up in Reader's Digest, but our company was the first one to pick it up because we were censoring mail. And this one boy, when we got to Carr Cross, said, he was writing to his mother, and he said, "Dear Mom, we are in Carr Cross, Yukon Territory, Canada. It belongs to the British, but don't worry, we'll get it back." And it apparently somebody sent it in to Reader's Digest, but it was
a lot of those guys were away from home for the first time and a long way from home. How did that work? Did they get regular mail, or were you lucky enough to?
Pretty much regular mail. They had had some problem there in that their folks couldn't write either, and that was another thing on the censoring. When they would write, be answering the writing to their folks, they were Cajun boys, and they were writing it in Cajun French. So we just signed it. We didn't. We couldn't read it. We figured if the Japs can do it, let them tell us what it is. But it they seemed to get along pretty well. And as I say, there was things, they had been used to working pretty hard physical work, and so they could continue doing it. There was the sports of the hunting and fishing that they could do on details to go out and pick up food, you know.
Some of those guys were pretty wood savvy too, weren't they?
Oh yeah,
country boys.
Yeah, that's right.
Didn't take them too long to make the adjustment to, from the deep south to the high north.
No, they when they first went up, they wore everything Uncle Sam issued all at once, of course. But they soon learned, and we learned a lot from the local people. Since we got up there in, got the Carr Cross in April, I think it was, and they were giving us tips as about the cold weather and how to handle it. And they told us, these parkas that the Army gave you are nice if you're going to be standing still, but don't wear them if you're going to be working, because they'll make it perspire, and then your clothes will freeze. And so they told us to wear a lot of layers of lighter thing. And we passed that on, and most all of them finally did that. If it was active at all, they'd just wear lighter clothes.
Did you get that leather boot issue in the beginning, or did they issue you something sensible for boots?
No, we had those mucklucks, they called them, but they weren't mucklucks.
Bunny boots?
Well, the high boots with the rubber bottoms, and of course they were the coldest things in the world. And later we got some moccasins, and a lot of us got some through the trading post there, and they told us to wear two or three pairs of socks and these moccasins, and that will let your foot move around and keep it from freezing. And it was a whole lot better than those things that the Army agents. They were all right in the summertime, but in the wintertime they weren't very good.
Did you get some frostbite problems, or did most everybody manage?
I had a few minor frostbite problems, but not anything too serious. It was we were really lucky in having people that, well, none of us were used to that kind of temperatures. I had experienced some cold temperatures, but not anything like that. 76 below in a tent.
Did Did you ever get a Quonset, or were you pretty much in tents the whole time?
No, we didn't get a Quonset until we got to, out in the Aleutians.
And what about leaves? Did you get a leave while you were up on the Alcan? How long were you there straight?
I was there from when we went in April until, I never did get one. And we pulled off the highway in January of 43. And went down.
You went in April of 43, or in April of 42?
April of 42.
So you actually were from April of 42 to January of 42, mm-hmm. with no leave, and the same with your men?
Same with the men, yeah. And when we got, we were moved down to Chilkoot Barracks at Haines, and several of the men got leave and went back home, and we planned on rotating them, and then they cut off all leaves and sent us out in the Aleutians. And those men stayed in the States. They just replaced it, put some other people in the outfit, and they never got back. It was only about three of them.
You just sent it off?
Not a.
You didn't have got any recreational equipment or anything?
No, no, didn't have any at all. And when we got back, we got down to Chilkoot, they had a big theater there, and we were in barracks, steam-heated barracks, and they had a theater and a new movie every day, and everybody went to every one of them. We filled the theater. In fact, that's when I saw the Bing Crosby singing White Christmas. Yeah, that movie, White Christmas, was on when we got there, and it was. So every time I hear that song, I think of the theater in Carcross.
You must have thought you'd died and gone to heaven. What about bars and showers and so on? What did you work out for that?
Well, you'd heat a bucket of water on the little stove on the tent, and that bucket of water was enough for. Then you'd pour it in your little canvas thing, you know. I mean, fill that little canvas thing up, and we'd. Wash her hair, or we'd clean her teeth, and we'd take a bath with that little bucket of water. That's because the only way to get the water, of course, in the winter was to freeze, thaw the snow and the ice around. So it was quite a job.
Did everybody have to do their own in addition to the work you were doing?
Yeah.
And what about the wood supply? Did you have a wood detail that finished you with wood?
Yeah, we had some men that would supply the mess hall equipment there, and the orderly would supply our tent, and they would pile the lumber and pile the logs, and people would go in and get it. It wasn't the lumber was right a few feet from us, and it was just had a couple men sawing wood there all the time and supplying the lumber. It wasn't really much of a problem.
And what about keeping vehicles going?
We'd keep a D4, a little cat, keep it idling all night so that we could pull the trucks and get, first we'd heat all the wheels with a torch to get them so they'd turn, and then get the cat to pull them around till we could get the motor started. It was quite a job.
After the Aleutians, you spent basically the rest of World War II in the Aleutians?
No, I went out in the Aleutians, and it was April 43, and we went to UMNAC, the 93rd that I was with, went to UMNAC, and then in